This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have a live in-studio interview with the Oregon Natural Resources Council's Christine Courant about Wilderness Week activities starting this weekend.
A University of Arkansas graduate was found innocent of attempting to provide material support to a Palestinian terrorist organization.
Federal and local police across the country, as well as some of the nation's best-known companies, have been gathering Americans' phone records from private data brokers without subpoenas or warrants.
And in the human cost of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,506 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. Information Clearinghouse.info reports 250,000 Iraqi civilians have been reportedly killed by military intervention in Iraq.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 20th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Woolner.
And I'm Josonia Watson. When Medicare launched prescription drug coverage, more than 20 insurance companies jumped together to get their share of business in Oregon. But a new study from an independent consulting firm shows four companies have the bulk of the market. Two Pacific Northwest companies are among the leaders in Oregon, along with two insurers who have dominated the national market. Portland-based ODS grabbed the largest chunk with 17% of the state's business. Spokane-based Asuria, a Regency Blue Cross Blue Shield subsidiary, was the fourth largest provider with 12% of the Oregon market. Humania, Inc., an investor-owned corporation headquartered in Louisville, Kentucky, claimed the second largest share with 16%. Another big investor-owned company, United Healthcare of Minneapolis, also had 16%.
At a meeting earlier this month, the Portland City Council discussed requiring the Portland Development Commission to pay construction workers prevailing wage on its development projects, regardless of whether the PDC exclusively funds them. A week before that meeting, the Portland office of the National Labor Relations Board served a complaint on Benson Tower LLC, a downtown condominium developer whose Canadian contractor has allegedly been running an arbitrary open shop. Has Portland's political establishment decided to turn up the heat on foreign contractors who bypass local collective bargaining? Michael Gene Horowitz has the story.
ITC is a Canadian company that is coming into town, and we're very afraid that they're going to try to lower the wages and working conditions of the workers of Portland in the construction field.
For the past year, there's been a new residential contractor in Portland. ITC of Vancouver, British Columbia, whose initial project, the 26-story Benson Tower at Southwest 11th and Clay, is owned by Benson Tower LLC, which to this reporter at times seems to act on ITC's behalf. On June 27th, the tower is slated to defend itself against federal prosecution for barring the reinstatement last winter of Cliff Puckett, a local carpenter whose union, the Northwest affiliate of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, claims he was refused solely for talking up the union at the Benson site. Over the past year, ITC has employed both union and non-union carpenters at the tower. You might be wondering why the Bush administration is prosecuting alleged retaliation for organizing. Well, despite considerable retrenchment since the New Deal, the National Labor Relations Board, like Old Man River, just keeps rolling on no matter which party is in power. Here in Portland over the past year, the local office has reportedly found merit in nearly 40% of some 200 allegations of unfair labor practice lodged by employees and unions. Usually a series of phone calls is all that's required to compel employers to make amends. But in some dozen cases, the region's general counsel has been forced to prosecute. And if settlement doesn't loom by next week, regional counsel may prosecute Benson Tower. In its answer to the NLRB last week, the Tower denied Puckett was barred for protected union activity. Yet its attorneys wouldn't explain to KBOO why the carpenter was refused. Sources close to Tower management, who wouldn't be attributed, suggest Puckett may have been re-terminated for inappropriate behavior on the Benson site. But Ben Embry, the organizing director of the Northwest Carpenters, whose warning led this segment, claims Puckett was barred solely because of informational efforts during breaks and lunchtime.
We're not trying to organize any company on that project. We're trying to educate the workers with what they could be making in the union side, such as wages, benefits, and all the pension and vacation that we have. We have a lot of work in the Portland area that they could go to, and they could make a living wage, which some of them aren't making on their project.
As for Puckett's behavior on site,
Cliff is an outstanding person. He's an outstanding carpenter, has not done anything illegal whatsoever. Everything he's done has been protected by labor law and the First Amendment.
Those same sources near Tower Management suggest that in site negotiation just prior to Puckett's re-termination, the carpenters may have pressed the Canadians to sign a national union agreement, but Embry denies that as well.
We in no way tried to make them sign any agreement internationally, regionally, or even bind them to a local agreement other than that site agreement that we offered them.
The carpenters recently confirmed receiving a proposed settlement from the Tower, and if negotiations prove promising, NLRB counsel may very well postpone hearing, and of course cancel it altogether if settlement is reached. Yet if the Tower intended to settle, why did it force the NLRB to issue complaint? Embry's analysis?
They just want to see if we're going to blank before they're going to blank.
KBOO will update listeners on resolution or hearing. For the evening news, this is Michael Jean Hurwitz.
Oregon is trying to clamp down on mercury emissions from Portland General Electric's coal-fired plant in Boardman. But a cement factory in eastern Oregon that emits four times as much mercury is unaffected. The factory is a Kansas-owned kiln in the town of Durkee in Baker County. It is not affected by federal laws aimed at power plants. Mercury in the air contaminates the food chain, including fish in many rivers and lakes. But the cement company and the feds say no cost-effective means is available to capture mercury coming from its plant, so there are no limits on the kiln. One proposal would control the Boardman coal plant emission beginning in 2018.
The Oregon Natural Resources Council has declared next week as Wilderness Week, and the organization has a lot of plans for the event. Live in Studio 2 with us to chat about this is Christine Courant. Thanks for coming in to KBOO, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
Great. First, can you talk a little bit about the Oregon Natural Resources Council? How long have you been around and what do you do?
Okay. ONRC, or Oregon Natural Resources Council, has been around for about 30 years. Started around a campfire. A bunch of young, excited guys really wanted to make sure that beautiful, wonderful, wild places in Oregon, our natural heritage, got protected. And so they started Oregon Natural Resources Council. We've been around for 30 years, and, you know, our moniker is really protecting Oregon's wildlands, wildlife, and waters. And we do so aggressively. We want to make sure that those are around for us to enjoy and for our future generations.
So on a related topic, we've heard a lot of stories about the Bush administration's new threats to wilderness areas. The federal government just auctioned off part of the Calmeopsis wilderness for logging, and groups are scrambling to win an injunction on that case. Can you give us an update on ONRC's efforts to get more wild areas protected?
Yeah, I sure can. ONRC has been working with our sister groups in Southern Oregon to work on preventing the Bush administration from logging in Oregon's largest roadless forest. And so we've been doing quite a bit of work down there, and the governor has been pretty helpful on this regard. But as in regards to what, you know, what folks around Oregon can do, and specifically in Portland, you can either contact ONRC or you can join us during Wilderness Week. We've got a hike heading down there to an area called Mike's Gulch. And that's an excellent chance to check out the area and learn more about the threats to that wonderful roadless area.
Great. So more on Wilderness Week. Why does the ONRC stage this event?
ONRC would like to get Portlanders and Oregonians out to the wild places that we love and cherish, but, you know, may not get to see all the time, or, you know, maybe folks don't know where they are. And so why not come with people who know where they are, know why they need to be protected, and it's free. So why not come join us? We've got a variety of hikes.
So what sort of events are going on? What are some highlights, and how can people participate?
All right. Well, we've got, as I mentioned, I mentioned hikes, but we also have fishing trips, which are hikes through old growth forest, and then you end up fishing. So kind of a well-rounded activity for the day. Also family-friendly hikes. We have film screenings and slideshows. There's one here in Portland next Wednesday at the Lucky Lab, and that's helpful for folks who don't really know much about Eastern Oregon. We're going to have someone come out from Eastern Oregon, talk about great places you can see out there. So why not come on down to the Lucky Lab, 6 p.m., join us for a beer, check out Eastern Oregon.
Cool. And I see that some of these events go to wilderness proposal areas.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that means?
Sure. All over Oregon, there are roadless areas that are pristine and haven't been logged and haven't had roads built in them. Those areas are then eligible for wilderness protection, which means that they will be protected into perpetuity, that people now and in the future will be able to enjoy those areas, to recreate in them, and to save that, you know, for the ecology of the system and that sort of thing, you know, to make sure that it's intact for the future. So there are wilderness proposals if that roadless area can then be protected. And so we've designated them all over the state. You can actually check that out at www.onrc.org. We have maps, and, you know, why not check those areas out and then also join us on our hikes and learn about wild areas all over the state.
Great. And how can folks stay involved after Wilderness Week is over?
Well, you can become a volunteer, and you can help us. We have action teams where folks, we get these really active people together, and they're the folks that actually write to the Forest Service, write to, you know, the Bush administration, write to a local official like county commissioners and that sort of thing, and say, hey, this area is really important to us. This is why, and, you know, I want you to protect it. So that's kind of our highest level of action. And then we have people that join us for community events, you know, will help us just participate in an event and be present, be known, and, you know, discuss what ONRC does. And then there's folks that, you know, just want to be a member and come on a hike with us. That's fine, too. You know, all the better. The more people we can get out to these wonderful wild places and really recognize Oregon's wild heritage and how great it is that we live in this place. I mean, so many people come to Portland especially, but all over the state because of the recreation opportunities and how beautiful it is. So let's get out there and see it.
Great.
Come join me.
Thank you so much, Christine.
Yeah, and feel free to check us out again at the website, www.onrc. You can also give me a call at 503-283-6343, extension 224.
All right. That was Christine Courant of the Oregon Natural Resources Council. The Wilderness Week events are beginning this weekend and will go on for a week.
Longtime Yakima Indian leader William Yalup died Saturday at his Topemish home at the age of 79. Yalup was raised with traditional Yakima teachings and spoke both Yakima and English. He spent 12 years in the armed forces and began serving in tribal government in 1960. He retired from the tribal council last year.
A former federal official in Washington state who pleaded guilty in a scheme to overcharge the government for natural gas received raises amounting to nearly $22,000 a year while he was under investigation. Payroll records for William R. Mitten of Battleground were released to the Associated Press under a Freedom of Information Act request. Mitten was director of the National Center for Utilities Management, an office of the General Services Administration in Vancouver. He was responsible for buying natural gas in bulk for federal facilities, including prisons and hospitals, around the country. Prosecutors said he accepted gratuities from Tiger Natural Gas of Tulsa, Oklahoma. He pleaded guilty in federal court in Tacoma in February to conspiracy to engage in conflicts of interest. During the 5 years he was under investigation, his pay rose from about $72,000 a year to $94,000 when he retired in December.
In Iraq, the U.S. military recovered the booby-trapped bodies of Privates First Class Thomas Lowell Tucker of Madrid and Kristen Minkia of Houston today. Iraqi officials said the Americans were tortured and killed. An insurgent group claimed the new leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq executed the men personally. Officials indicated the men had been decapitated. The discovery of the bodies dealt a new setback to U.S. efforts to seize the momentum against al-Qaeda in Iraq after killings its leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, in a June 7 airstrike. Violence was unabated today, with at least 18 people killed in attacks nationwide, including a suicide bombing of a home for elderly in the southern city of Basra. Coalition forces spotted the American soldiers' bodies late Monday, 3 days after the men disappeared following an attack on their checkpoint south of the capital, the military said. But troops delayed retrieving the remains until an explosive team cleared the area after Iraqi civilians warned them to be alert for explosive devices.
American military spokesman Major General William Caldwell said today that there were still 13 Americans missing in Iraq, two soldiers and 11 civilians. He identified the two soldiers as Sergeant Matt Maupin, missing since April 2004, and Captain Michael Speecher, a Navy pilot missing since the 1991 Persian Gulf War. There are also 11 American citizens that today are still listed as missing in action, he said, without identifying them. Either DOD contractors, civilian contractors, or others, but American citizens that have been reported as missing over the last 3 years.
A Lodi man faces 39 years in prison on terrorism charges after a federal judge rejected a request to dismiss some of his convictions. Hamid Hayat was convicted in April of one count of providing material support to terrorists by attending a terror training camp in Pakistan and the three counts of lying about it to FBI agents. His attorney says federal prosecutors were piling on prison time by charging three versions of the same lying offense, all stemming from the FBI's questioning a year ago. Each count brings up to 8 years in federal prison, while the material support charge carries a potential 15-year sentence. Judge Garland Burrell says the three lying charges are different enough to merit the separate convictions. Hyatt was convicted based on the testimony of a CIA operative recruited from a convenience store in Bend, Oregon. His father, an ice cream truck driver from Sacramento, was also convicted in the case.
An attempt to keep oil companies from reaping as much as $10 billion because of an error involving royalty payments is gaining momentum in Congress. The issue is to be the focus of two House panels tomorrow. Executives of five oil and gas companies, including Shell Oil Company, which was subpoenaed to appear, are scheduled to be questioned by the House Reform Energy and Resources Subcommittee on their involvement in the questionable contracts. Later, the House Resources Committee takes up legislation that would impose significant financial penalties on any company that refuses to reopen faulty offshore leases that were negotiated in 1998 and 1999. Last month, the House included in a broader refinery bill a provision that would bar a company from getting new offshore oil leases from the Interior Department unless the contentious 1990s leases are revoked.
A consortium of federal agencies has begun the process of identifying thousands of miles of utility corridors in 11 western states. The corridors, which crisscross the rural West, may be used for power, gas, and oil lines intended to serve the region's growing population. So far, the public only has access to a preliminary low-resolution map of where the corridors may cross federal land. The map is already raising concerns among an array of environmental groups who fear more development in sensitive habitat. Aaliyah Roberas has more.
The low-resolution map on the Internet seems to show the utility corridors crossing crucial spotted owl habitat in Oregon's Mount Hood National Forest. Other routes border on California's Mojave National Preserve, Washington's McNary Wildlife Refuge, Idaho's Craters of the Moon National Monument, and near Utah's Canyonlands National Park. Federal land-owning agencies are tasked by the 2005 Energy Policy Act with mapping utility corridors in the West by August 2007. Bureau of Land Management spokesperson Heather Sweeney says more than half of the corridors on the map are already in service, but environmentalists say it's unclear how much wider the existing corridors would become. Sweeney says federal agencies are using the width of two-thirds of a mile for analysis purposes.
It needs to be wide enough and designed such that it's possible to use the corridor for more than one project.
Sweeney says the routes will be analyzed for compliance with the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, and other environmental laws. She says a more detailed map will be released as part of an environmental impact statement late this year, followed by another public comment period. Even then, she says, there's no guarantee anything will be built. That would require a utility to come forward with a plan.
And then further environmental impact analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act would be done on a site and project specific basis.
Chris Mill of the Wilderness Society says just like roads, energy corridors tend to fragment habitat.
Even from the preliminary maps, it looks like, for example, that there is a route through the Lake Mead recreation area and also one that goes through the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. Neither of those corridors are anywhere near an existing road, so they'd be incredibly expensive to maintain from a taxpayer point of view, but they also would go right through the heart of areas that are now used by citizens for recreation, but also by wildlife for winter habitat and such.
Howard Wilshire, chair of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, has studied the impacts of pipeline and power corridors in desert ecosystems such as the Mojave. Wilshire says builders will bulldoze a 100-foot swath for a 30-inch pipeline.
They claim that this is for safety purposes, but it's not. It just makes it easier for them. And the result of that, of course, is that everything that lives in that corridor is killed.
Wilshire says a number of species are at risk, including the threatened Mojave Desert tortoise. He says habitat recovery in the desert is extremely slow. Wilshire calls the utility corridor process a quick and dirty way for industry to get what it wants while the Bush administration is still in power.
The hurry-up and rush procedure is not warranted. We already have designated corridors throughout the West.
Janine Blaylock, director of the Seattle-based Western Lands Project, says the corridor program is part of a pattern her group has seen regarding the privatization of public lands throughout the West, where numerous forces are rallied against the protection of public lands.
The motivations are often hidden, and some great public purpose will be declared for using a piece of public land, and then you find down the line that that's not what's going on at all, that really it's all a scheme to bring it into some type of development.
Comments on the preliminary utility corridor map are due Monday, July 10th. The map is linked to the BLM homepage. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News.
A New York senator accused the drug giant Merck & Company today of conspiring to undercut a cheaper generic alternative to its cholesterol-lowering drug, Zocor, just days before it becomes available to patients. Senator Charles Schumer, a Democrat, charged that Merck is quietly collaborating with health insurance companies to create lower copays for customers buying Zocor than for those buying the generic equivalent. Zocor generated $4.4 billion in sales last year, and generic alternatives will be available for the first time on Friday. A company executive scoffed at Schumer's allegations. Typically, generics offer customers a steep discount on the cost of the original drug, but Schumer is complaining that Zocor is trying to turn that market upside down by encouraging an insurance copay system in which Zocor would have a significantly lower copay than the generic version. Schumer charged the company had already struck one such agreement with a health insurance company and asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate.
100 Louisiana National Guard troops and 60 state police arrived in New Orleans this morning to assist local police in dealing with the city's violent crime. Kristen Roseland has the story.
Yesterday, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco requested 300 National Guard be deployed to the troubled city after this weekend's murder of five teenagers in New Orleans' Central City neighborhood. Governor Blanco's office says the additional guardsmen will arrive in the next few days. Another man was fatally stabbed this morning, blocks away from this weekend's murders. Though less than half the city has returned since last fall's storm, per capita violent crime rates have met or exceeded pre-Katrina levels in New Orleans in recent months. New Orleans led the nation in per capita murders for several years before last fall's storm, and the state of Louisiana has the world's highest incarceration rate. Yesterday, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin's office said the city will reinstate a juvenile curfew, which was in effect in the 1990s. For FSRN, this is Christian Roseland in New Orleans.
2 weeks on the job, the new head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection said today he does not favor building a huge wall along the Mexican border. Asked about proposals in Senate and House-approved immigration measures to build security walls 380 or 700 miles long, respectively, Basham said, quote, "It doesn't make sense. It's not practical. As Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano put it, you build a 50-foot wall, somebody will find a 51-foot ladder," end quote. Fencing including so-called smart fencing with embedded sensors, vehicle barriers, and lighting, will be part of the infrastructure improvements needed, Basham said. But a layered approach that mixes technology and air operations for observation and responding to illegal crossings will be necessary to control the border, he said. Basham is touring the Southwest border region for a first-hand look at the challenges the Border Patrol is facing as National Guard troops arrive to begin assisting efforts to control the border.
The Japanese Prime Minister announced today that his country will withdraw its troops from Iraq, just 1 week after Italy began to pull its forces out of the region. The decision to send troops to Iraq has been unpopular in Japan, a country that has not had an active military presence in a war zone since World War II. The Japanese withdrawal may be complete as early as next month. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is taking up its own measures to withdraw troops from the war-torn country. Democrats are offering two separate proposals, both of which are garnering little support from Republicans. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
One amendment by Senators John Kerry from Massachusetts, Russ Feingold from Wisconsin, and Barbara Boxer from California will call for the redeployment of U.S. troops out of Iraq by July 1st of next year. Senator Boxer.
We need to change the mission that we're on in Iraq. We need to allow the Iraqis to take care of their own security. We need to concentrate on continuing to train them. We need to concentrate on getting al-Qaeda. We need to concentrate on protecting our personnel over there and removing and redeploying the vast majority of our troops. And we give a date certain, which would be the middle of next year of 07.
The second amendment, called the Reed-Levin Amendment, named after Senators Jack Reed from Rhode Island and Carl Levin from Michigan, it is similar in that it would keep some military in the region to fight al-Qaeda and to protect military projects and its workers. The difference, though, is the timeline. The Reed-Levin Amendment says the president begin a phased redeployment of U.S. troops this year with the permission of the Iraqi parliament, and no deadline is set. At airtime, many Democrats were still undecided on which amendment to support, but dismissed claims that the party is split on how to proceed. Democratic leader Harry Reid from Nevada.
The Bush administration must come up with a plan, not to stay the course, but tell the American people what his plan is to start redeploying troops. But one thing Democrats agree on is this war has taken too long. It's too expensive and cost too many lives and too many soldiers injured. We all agree there should be a change in the course of the war. We all agree that there should be a redeployment starting sooner rather than later.
But how they vote will reveal their stance on troop withdrawal. Republicans are prepared for the debate that could last until tomorrow. They oppose a U.S.-imposed timeline. Republican Lindsey Graham from South Carolina.
For us to suggest a timetable to withdraw is a sign of weakness. It's an empowerment act to terrorism. For the Iraqi sovereign government to suggest a timetable withdrawal would be a sign of strength.
Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona suggests that the difference between Democrats and Republicans is strategy.
Americans want withdrawal. I want withdrawal. They want withdrawal. The question is how? And I think it's not a date. It's not when, it's how.
Both Democratic amendments say that the war in Iraq is hurting the war on terror. Also in the Senate, lawmakers rejected for the third time an amendment that would investigate corporate reconstruction contracts in Iraq. The vote failed along party lines, with Republicans saying the Congress does enough oversight on the projects. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
People across the world are observing World Refugee Day today, which was established by the United Nations in 2000 to recognize the international contribution of refugees. The United States remains the largest resettlement country in the world. Over 2.6 million people have found new homes here since 1975. One place refugees often find themselves is Utica in upstate New York, home of the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees. Danuta Zafraniak reports from Utica.
Utica is a picturesque town located in the Mohawk Valley, upstate New York. At Genesis Street is a former Catholic school that houses Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees. It is estimated that nearly 10,000 refugees from over 26 countries, including Italy, Ireland, Poland, Sudan, China, and the former Soviet republics, have settled the area. Sidi Shivala is 24 years old. He arrived here from Somalia in April 2004.
We were in Somalia as a slave, and when the civil war started, I remember my sister, she was raped in front of me. If I remember those things happening in Somalia, make me never go back. My life is right now totally different. I got two cars. I'm working. I got three-bedroom apartment. I got my wife. I have a baby, trying to have a new life.
In the last few years, the most numerous group of refugees have come to Utica from Bosnia. The country was included in the U.S. resettlement program by the resolution of the American Congress in 1993. Poland does not qualify for the program anymore, but the Central helped many Poles in a post-Solidarity era. Andrzej Moskal came to Utica in 1984 as a political refugee from a camp in Austria.
After my arrival, I started learning English in the center. There were about 15 Poles together with me there in 1984 to 85 who came from the refugee camps in Italy or Germany. There were also refugees seeking freedom who arrived from Cambodia, Vietnam, and Laos. The center helped them with housing and food. After 6 months of English classes, it also helped find jobs for them.
Established in 1981, the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees has aided thousands of refugees in finding housing, jobs, schools, language training, and citizenship lessons. It is funded mainly through governmental sources as well as private donations. Its executive director, Peter Vogelaar, says that the main aim is to convince fellow Americans, in view of the current anti-immigrant sentiment, that refugees constitute a vital part of their society.
I think the national debate is colored by some of recent history and the challenges that we've had as a nation dealing with the post-9/11 environment. We are a nation of immigrants. Utica is an exemplary community of how it has welcomed these people from all sorts of different nations and what the possibilities are for the future if we really open up our hearts and minds to what immigrants can contribute to our nation.
Another important aspect of assistance is job placement, which is not an easy task, taking into consideration the language barrier and different work ethic. The biggest employer in the area is ConMed, but refugees also find employment in smaller enterprises. According to Michael Fitzgerald, owner of Oriskany Manufacturing Technologies, the benefits of a large refugee population outweigh the challenges.
Based on the experience we've had, I think it's an overlooked resource.
Even in spite of the language problems?
That barrier is just something that can be overcome. So when you realize the value and the merit and the willingness and the ability, it's a very good opportunity for both employer and employee.
The tragic events of September 11, 2001 drastically impacted refugee resettlement to the United States. Their number has declined from an average of 70,000 annually before 2001 to 28,000 in 2003. The impact on the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees has been substantial. In 2003, the center resettled only 256 refugees. Those who work there argue, however, that refugees do not want to be refugees all their lives. They just want to start all over and hence should be given another chance. I am Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, Utica, upstate New York.
The current time is 5:33, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a surprise. George W. wants to turn the illegal immigration issue into another multi-billion dollar boondoggle for giant corporations. Such military contractors as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman are lined up at the federal trough yet again, drooling at what Bush calls the Secure Border Initiative. This scheme will give government contracts to corporations to build a high-tech virtual fence along our nation's borders. We are launching the most technologically advanced border security initiative in American history, bragged Bush. Actually, that's not a very high hurdle, for our history of border security is littered with high-priced technological failures. Take the nearly $500 million program of cutting-edge technologies that corporate contractors provided for the Mexican border just a few years ago. Half of the cameras didn't work or were never installed. The ground sensors did set off alarms, but in 92% of the cases they were triggered not by illegals, but by a wild animal or a passing train. Now, here they come again. Lockheed Martin, for example, is touting its tethered aerostat radar as a border solution. This massive blimp, twice the size of Goodyear's, would be tethered to the ground by a long cable, monitoring all movement below. One little problem, though, it can't be used in high winds. Another piece of razzle-dazzle technology was a $6.8 million unmanned plane to patrol the border. It crashed in April, after less than a year's use. This is Jim Hightower saying, these military contractors have sorry records of cost overruns, fraud, and products that are defective or useless. We're to turn border security over to them? Bush's scheme is all about political posturing and fattening his corporate backers. The problem of illegal immigration requires an honest economic solution, not merely buying more hardware from high-tech hucksters.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay with us for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear a KBOO News special, Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom. Out Loud and Prison Pipeline will both return next week. And at 7, it's Clemmy's Grooves with your host, Clemmy Jones. For the weather, Willamette Valley weather sunny with a few clouds, highs approaching 75 degrees. In the Columbia Gorge, mostly sunny with highs around 85. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Justice Department today won its first trial in the probe of influence peddler Jack Abramoff, convincing a former Bush administration official in a case that touched on questionable behavior by members of Congress. A juror found David Savavian had hidden details of his relationship with Abramoff from a General Services Administration ethics lawyer, the GSA's Inspector General's office, and the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and had obstructed the Inspector General. Safavian, the GSA's former chief of staff, could face up to 5 years in prison on each of those four counts. He was acquitted of obstructing the Senate probe. The guilty verdict is expected to give a boost to a wide-ranging federal investigation that includes lawmakers, their aides, and members of the Bush administration. In Miami, meanwhile, a judge granted Abramoff and ex-business partner Adam Kindin another 3 months before they must begin serving prison sentences for fraud convictions stemming from the purchase of a gambling boat fleet. Abramoff also faces sentencing in Washington on federal charges of conspiracy, tax evasion, and mail fraud.
Federal and local police across the country, as well as some of the nation's best-known companies, have been gathering Americans' phone records from private data brokers without subpoenas or warrants. These brokers, many of whom market aggressively across the Internet, have broken into customer accounts online, tricked phone companies into revealing information, and sometimes acknowledged that their practices violate laws, according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. Legal experts and privacy advocates said police reliance on private vendors who commit such acts raises civil liberties questions. Those using data brokers include agencies of the Homeland Security and Justice Departments, including the FBI and U.S. Marshals Service, and municipal police departments in California, Florida, Georgia, and Utah. Experts believe hundreds of other departments frequently use such services. Congressional investigators estimated the U.S. government spent $30 million last year buying personal data from private brokers.
Students from the University of Andes in Mérida, Venezuela, recently participated in a peaceful march demanding university autonomy. Businesses closed down, covering their windows, and leftist students stayed away from downtown and clustering in groups for their own safety. The march comes on the heels of an event 3 weeks ago when a student organization called the Movimiento 13 de Mérida held violent protests. Host Sue Wilson reports from Mérida, Venezuela.
The Movimiento 13 de Marzo, also known as the 13, claims that last month's protests were a response to a decision made by the National Supreme Court. The court was responding to student claims that professors and university officials at the University of the Andes were interfering in student elections. Jessica Petkoff is an active member of the Trece.
The protests were rooted in the suspension of the student elections, which were going to be held May 31st, but were suspended.
The Trece claims that this is an attack on university autonomy, but other students say that the protests have nothing to do with student autonomy and a lot to do with national politics, as Venezuela moves towards national presidential elections in December. Leonardo Bedal studies political science at the University of the Andes, or ULA. He says that the ULA student government elections are part of a power struggle between students and the national opposition to President Hugo Chavez.
On the question of the changes in the ULA elections, election tables, as we say, are exclusively made up of professors, and the majority of the professors of the university have right-wing tendencies or are in the opposition.
Accounts from students and professors present during the protests indicate that groups of armed protesters arriving in university buses spread a much more explicit message. Business administration student Eduardo Balsa is a member of Utopia 78, a progressive student organization which supports Chavez.
On Thursday, the second day of the protests, a commander group, because there is no other word to define it, arrived at this campus with guns screaming, "Where are the Chavistas? Where are the people from Utopia 78? Where are the 86ers? Where are the communists? Come out, communists. Communism will not enter into this university."
Venezuela's history is full of police brutality against students, and since Hugo Chavez was elected in 1998, it has become illegal for police to respond to student protests with firearms. During the protests last month, 37 police officers and one member of the National Guard were injured, three critically and 21 by gunfire. Many Venezuelans speculate that the unprecedented use of firearms by the students, who covered their faces with ski masks and t-shirts, was an attempt to provoke the police into arming themselves and firing back at the protesters, causing a student death.
They need to have a death. They need to have a martyr to create the logical conditions for a protest of greater magnitude, because they don't have it. There were very few who protested.
The public reaction to the Trece's violent tactics was very negative. Last Friday's march was framed as a ULA march for university autonomy, but was actually a march by the opposition to the national government designed to clean up the image of the Trece. Marchers held signs for political opposition parties Primera Justicia and Bandera Roja next to flags of the Trece and signs that said no to violence. In reference to the stripping and attempted rape of police officer Sofia Aguilar, who in her testimony identified the Trece's leader, Nixon Moreno, as the man who shot her partner, marchers chanted, "The only one raped was the university," and carried giant signs saying, "We are all Nixon." For Free Speech Radio News in Mérida, I'm Josue Wilson.
The trial of an Argentine police chief accused of murder and torture during the country's military dictatorship marks the end of a 20-year-old amnesty law. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Retired police officer Miguel Echecolas is accused of involvement in six murders, as well as torture and illegal arrest during the 1976-1983 dictatorship's dirty war against opponents. His trial opened this morning and is expected to last several weeks. Human rights activists and relatives of the disappeared booed Echecolas as he left the courtroom in La Plata, 37 miles from Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires. Echecolas is the first military officer in 20 years to face new charges of forced disappearances. This after Argentina's Supreme Court struck down legal immunity for former officers who served during the era of military dictatorship is unconstitutional. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Turkey's government is preparing to pass a new legislation, an anti-terror bill that critics claim violates democracy and freedom of expression. Ezi Sarinis reports.
On Monday, the main opposition party, CHP, Republican People's Party, and the government party agreed upon the disputes they had over the new anti-terror law. However, the civil society organizations and press concerns about the law continue. Most organizations believe that the law will remove the rights and freedoms granted in the last few years as a part of Turkey's EU integration policies. Human Rights Association leader Yusuf Alataş explains what kind of changes the new law would bring.
Bu yasa değiştirilme çalışmaları içerisinde
In this new bill that is prepared, terror is defined in a very inclusive way. There is no clear terror definition made, and many things are taken as a terror activity. With this discourse about terror, rights and freedoms are restricted and the police powers are increased. Prosecutorial power is limited and they are transferred to police. All NGOs, political parties, intellectuals, and especially the press will be affected by this law. Ordinary citizens will be affected directly too, as more than 50 crimes are named as terrorism.
The bill is criticized especially for violating the freedom of expression and press freedom. Many civil society organizations, newspapers, and intellectuals started a campaign claiming that the new anti-terror law is actually an anti-society law. İnce Hekimoğlu from Bir Gün, a left-wing newspaper that is part of the campaign, explains why the government tries to pass such an anti-democratic bill now after many democratic reforms had been undertaken since 1999.
After the Cold War, America has started to promote a terror ideology. As part of this worldwide trend started by America, Turkey is now trying to adopt an anti-terror law. The threat of communism is replaced by the concept of terror. The concept of terror is an ambiguous one. It changes according to who's defining it, in what context.
There are already many lawsuits against intellectuals such as Eren Keskin, Perihan Maden, and Murat Belge because of the articles, books they wrote, and statements they made. Many activists say that these lawsuits represent what the anti-terror bill will bring after it becomes a law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sarıtaş from Ankara, Turkey.
The Taliban's influence in Waziristan, the tribal region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, is growing, some say, because of a lack of basic facilities like education, health, and jobs. The Taliban have set up their own courts, collect taxes, and hold sway over the political administration traditionally run by Pakistan. Young boys sometimes join their ranks because they see it as an alternative to the Pakistan army, which is at times viewed as an extension of U.S. imperialism. The Taliban also offers a social system in which the powerful landlords, known as maliks, cannot exploit the poor. So far, the Taliban has been successful in bringing back a certain type of stability to the region after the Pakistan army launched a military operation to flush out terrorists in 2003. FSRN's Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Tribal areas are the forgotten backyard of Pakistan, a population of around 600,000 people. The region became a hideout for terrorists and the Afghan Taliban, who sought sanctuary in a largely religious population. Mushahadullah is a university student who returned from North Waziristan last night.
These people came here a long time ago and have settled here, and it is these people who are offering resistance to attacks launched by the Pakistani government. And all these people have in their possession to resist attacks are the weapons and ammunition they brought with them from Afghanistan. The Pakistan army has a lot of firepower, and it is using air attacks on our people. It is difficult to say who is more powerful, the local Taliban, which is offering resistance, or the Pakistan government.
When the Pakistan army launched a military attack on Waziristan, the local population, which looked up to them as their protectors, began to view them as the enemy, and they looked for a new savior. Alamgir Masood is a tribal leader visiting Islamabad from Waziristan.
People are joining the Taliban, and the trend is that if people from one tribe see that the Taliban is becoming a force to reckon with, and they decide to join them, people from rival tribes who are worried about their survival will also join them, even if they are not convinced that the Taliban is a force to reckon with. This is the reason why Taliban are becoming a dominant force.
According to news coming out of North Waziristan, Taliban are divided into two groups. One is led by a moderate Baitullah Masood and the other by Abdullah Khan. Alamgir Masood again.
One of the Taliban commanders is Abdullah, who is said to have prepared a force of 20,000 registered fighters. The other commander is Baitullah, who has a force of 36,000 fighters. The question arises, who is funding these forces with all this equipment and vehicles? There is a strong impression in the region that it is some hidden hand which is behind all this.
Local analysts say social conditions are an important factor in strengthening the local Taliban, including a lack of schools and colleges in the tribal areas. Rahmatullah Khan is a tribal journalist.
Education ratio overall is about...
The literacy rate in our tribal region of South Waziristan is 5%, and the literacy rate for females is zero. There is no concept of education for girls. Therefore, I would say that in order to promote social development and spread awareness, the government of Pakistan should launch an accelerated program of mass education. I believe education plays a basic role in development and social change.
Meanwhile, in Islamabad, the Pakistan government announced it will give the local Taliban some time before it launches another military attack to put down resistance. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
A University of Arkansas graduate was found innocent of attempting to provide materials to support a Palestinian terrorist organization. But Anwar Jabir has been convicted of lesser charges, including making false statements on immigration documents. After the verdict, Jabir said, quote, "I am not a terrorist. The jury knew it." Jabir faces a maximum of 10 years in prison on each count of obtaining his naturalization unlawfully and making false statements. Jabir said he now expects to leave the country with his wife, Dawn, and find a teaching position in the Middle East.
The United Nations is investigating allegations that its peacekeepers in the Democratic Republic of Congo opened fire on a village despite the presence of civilians. The report, published in the London-based Observer newspaper on Sunday, also claimed that South African and Pakistani peacekeeping troops stood by as Congolese troops set fire to houses in the village. The United Nations has the largest peacekeeping force in the world deployed in DRC. The 17,000 troops are stationed in the country ahead of its first military party elections in four decades, due at the end of July.
A new bus service across the divided territory of Kashmir has begun linking the town of Panich in the Indian-administered side with Rawalpindi in Pakistani-controlled side. The bus service will cover a distance of 55 kilometers and will be the second cross-border service linking the disputed region. India and Pakistan have fought two of their three wars since independence in 1947 over the region, which they both claim as theirs.
A census of civil servants in Cameroon has revealed that huge sums of money are being paid out each month to non-existent workers. The government discovered it has been paying pensions worth around $9 million to 9,000 so-called ghost workers every month. They also found that family allowances were being paid to people who were not married and had no children, and that some civil servants were being paid inflated salaries. The census is being carried out in an attempt to streamline government spending and to tackle fraud.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 20th, 2006. If you have comments or questions about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Our assistant producer is Ross Egan. Tonight's AP Wire editors are Crystal Leety and Ross Egan. Our audio editor is Jacob Finston. Special thanks to reporter Michael Horowitz. Our engineer is Eve Focali and Judy Fasol. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Jo Sonia Watson.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, hear Barbara Bernstein, who's hosting Locus Focus Talk Radio. In the early part of her show, she'll interview Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute about the new report Cascadia Scorecard 2006, which looks at the relationship between urban sprawl and health. At 9 o'clock, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. And at 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues It's Happening Here, his year-long look at fascism in the United States. Joining him to discuss controlled mass media are Norman Solomon, author and syndicated media critic, and Brent Cunningham, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. At 10:30, Alon Robb hosts a special program on the World Cup, the tournament mesmerizing billions around the globe this month. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 20th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Transporting electricity, oil, gas, and hydrogen from production sites to cities and towns in the coming years will mean more transmission lines and pipelines. The federal government is working on designating energy highways for distribution throughout the West, and the first round of maps have some gaps that are raising questions. Nada Culver with the Wilderness Society says the routes appear to go through wildlife refuges, Indian reservations, and private land in New Mexico.
The corridor line just stops at the border of the land and then picks up exactly on the other side as if you flew over it.
Culver says mapping out routes to transport energy takes careful assessment of the mix of land involved.
Very good idea to determine the best places to put energy corridors and keep it away from places that would be more sensitive.
Culver says moving the lines a few miles could clear up environmental concerns, as well as worries by private landowners and tribal land. The corridors are required to be in place by next year under federal law. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., hearings this week include discussion over Native-only contracting and the Voting Rights Act. Joel Southern from the Alaska Public Radio Network has details.
Federal government sole source contracts benefiting Alaska Native corporations have gotten a lot of attention over the past year. In wake of the Gulf Coast hurricane disasters last summer, there was criticism of a contract one ANC had to supply trailers for temporary school use. Local suppliers argued they could have delivered the trailers at a much lower cost. There was also criticism about what kind of job another Native corporation subsidiary did providing contract security services at military bases. And other minority contractors have complained about the share of federal contracts ANCs have gotten. The House Government Reform and Small Business Committees will hold a joint oversight hearing Wednesday about ANC contracting with testimony from corporation leaders and Congressman Don Young. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, the House plans to hold floor debate on a bill to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, which, among other things, mandates written language assistance to facilitate voting by Native Americans and other U.S. citizens with limited English skills. There's a dispute about whether the language help requirement should continue, but a recent report by the Native American Rights Fund claims that the state of Alaska has long failed to comply with the law when it comes to aiding Alaska Natives. I'm Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
Southern Ute drums echoed through the valley south of Durango, Colorado last week during a traditional dedication ceremony for the new Mercy Regional Medical Center at Three Springs. KSUT's Joan Swisler was there and files this story.
Prayer, songs, and traditional dancing were all a part of the Southern Ute celebration of the completion of the new hospital. The state-of-the-art facility and campus is on 35 acres of tribally owned property. It is land where a more than 2,200-unit housing development and commercial development called Three Springs is under construction. Several of those present thanked the tribe for that contribution to the community, including John Whitney, who spoke on behalf of Congressman John Salazar.
Without the tribe's donation of land and payment for the Highway 160 interchange, we would not have this facility today.
Anne Brown read comments from U.S. Senator Ken Salazar, who said the structure represents the hope for and faith in the future, a sentiment echoed by Southern Ute Tribal Council Vice Chairman Matthew Box and others, who gave honor to previous tribal leaders. Box pointed out that past leaders had the foresight to support the people of the area in this way.
And how the people fare through their lives,
has a direct reflection on how well and productive we can work as a community.
Speaking on behalf of Mercy Regional Medical Center's Board of Directors and Catholic Health Initiatives, Board Chair Joanne Spina said Mercy is proud of the hospital's 124 years of service in Southwest Colorado.
But our history is so short by comparison to the centuries that the Southern Ute Indian Tribe has been a positive influence in this region.
Spina presented tribal leaders with a plaque commemorating the tribe's contribution. A duplicate plaque will be placed on the Mercy campus. Little Miss Southern Ute summed up the day in this lighthearted way. I hope you don't get sick, but if you do, you have a comfortable place to get well. From KSUT, I'm Joan Zwistler.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com.
Press Watch will be on at a new time Thursday mornings, 30 minutes earlier at 9 o'clock. I'm Teresa Mitchell, inviting you to tune in at 9 a.m. Thursdays to examine all the stories that corporate media would rather spin or ignore. What's the latest on global warming, imperial wars, corporate-owned government, and the fascistization of the United States? Find out Thursdays at 9 here on KBOO, People-Powered Community Radio.
And it's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.